Do you ever catch yourself saying, English is just crazy? Maybe your students come across a tricky word and you tell them, you just have to memorize that one, or this is the part you have to know by heart. But deep down, you know it's still confusing. Here's the truth. English isn't random. It's a wonderfully complex system, and once you understand how that system works, through sound, structure, and meaning, everything changes. That's what Sarah Paul and I teach inside Mastering Morphology. This isn't another curriculum. It's deep teacher knowledge inside a practical comprehensive course that finally shows you how words really work. No more exceptions, no more gimmicks or patching holes with memorization or phonics alone. It's time to go beyond sound it out and give your students the framework they need to truly understand words. So if you're ready to stop guessing and start teaching with confidence, join us inside Mastering Morphology. Enrollment is open now, so we invite you to click the link in the show notes to get started. You're listening to episode 61 of Illiteracy in Color. October is Dyslexia Awareness Month, and every Friday this month, we're bringing you a bonus episode focused on dyslexia. Be sure to check out the link in the show notes for the full Dyslexia Awareness playlist. This particular episode will also be found on our Coaching Conversations playlist, because this conversation with Jean Peake is targeted towards coaching teachers to reach every learner. Jean Peake is a lower school literacy specialist in Georgia and is entering her 14th year in education. She's a certified practitioner at the associate level through the Orton-Gillingham Academy. Jean began her career in Atlanta public schools as a first and second grade teacher. She went on to serve as a small group interventionist in grades K-2 and has also supported many children through her private tutoring practice. Ultimately, Jean returned to the classroom where her heart belongs while continuing her mission of supporting families and coaching teachers in structured literacy practices. In today's conversation, Jean shares her experiences with early screening, intervention, and how coaching can help teachers feel equipped to reach every learner, including those with dyslexia. Welcome to the Literacy in Color podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Sullivan, a science of reading advocate with over a decade of experience as a reading interventionist and literacy coach. I'm passionate about making evidence-based instruction both effective and engaging. If you're interested in captivating our learners on reading fluently and understanding language, or as I like to call it, keeping it colorful, then you've found the right place. Each week, we'll explore intriguing lit bits and practical strategies around the science of reading and structured literacy to help you be colorful and teach colorfully. Are you ready to bring literacy to life? Let's color outside the lines and make an impact together. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Literacy in Color. Here we have another bonus episode for Dyslexia Awareness Month, where we are meeting with some experts and educators in the field to tackle all things dyslexia. And today we have the pleasure of meeting with Jean Peake, who is a reading interventionist. And honestly, I was just telling her, one of my favorite people to follow on social media. She's a wealth of knowledge and has so much valuable content to share. And today we're going to be chatting about screening for dyslexia, what that looks like in the educational space, as well as high impact strategies that we can utilize in the classroom for students with dyslexia and honestly to support all learners. So first of all, welcome to the show, Jean.
Thank you so much, Michelle. I'm honored to be here. We were just chatting before hitting record, and you are one of my favorite follows as well. I just love this community, this colorful community you've created here, and I love the heart behind your message, and I love getting to collaborate and talk about how we can best serve our students, especially those who have learning differences.
And we are all in this work together, and I think that's what makes it so, so special. Would you briefly just share your background in education and especially as it relates to literacy?
Yes, I would love to. So I've been in the world of literacy for the last 14 years. I've been working as first a public school educator in first grade, which is the year for teaching kids how to break the code. And so I learned quickly there. And fast forward, I was a classroom teacher, then became an interventionalist in small groups, K through two. And now I am a literacy specialist / learning specialist in a lower school right outside of Atlanta. And I primarily work with kindergarten through second grade in an intervention-based method. So we have small groups that we assess and identify as students who need support. And then I also have a push-in model where I come in and support teachers. And I also have a little bit of a hybrid role as a coach. So we work on executive function skills. I'm a part of a team that works K through 12 to make sure that students of all abilities have access to excellent education. So we are looking at cognitive science. We are, and then in my special little niche, I get to work with those early readers and helping to provide early intervention that is proactive rather than reactive. And I just get to come alongside of teachers and families as we meet together to best serve our students. So that role I've been in for, this is my third year, and it is by far my favorite role. Well, besides being a mom, I have three sons who are also in school with me. So it's awesome. And so I get to see them walking in the hallways, and I also have a middle schooler now. So life is full and fun and wonderful, but that's me.
Oh, how fun. I love how you have your mom hat on even at school. That's so special. I bet your boys love that.
Hope so.
So your role is so interesting. I always find it really unique when interventionists and coaches have this kind of like dual role, because sometimes those positions are separated, sometimes they're together, and it can look different from school to school and district to district. And I know you play a role when it comes to screening and dyslexia screening and assessment and those types of things. So why is it so important to screen every single student? And especially when we consider the statistics, when we have 1 in 5 students who may have dyslexia in our classrooms.
Yes, I love that you bring about that statistic, because it could be even more. And if we think about those learning differences, dyslexia isn't the only thing that impacts reading. However, it is 80% of those who have reading disorders have dyslexia. So we know that it is a massive undertaking to in a big population of our students. And then, of course, there's a spectrum within that. So screening all students is super important. We want to know who's in front of us, regardless of their strengths as a reader and where their strengths lie, because we could have a really strong reader who needs to be screened for something small. Maybe the nonsense word component isn't their strength. They're a strong sight word reader because they just have been able to memorize those words. So we want to screen everyone, and we especially want to look for those markers of dyslexia. And we personally at our school, we use Dibbles, and we have MClass that comes alongside of that, which is a digital platform. And it makes my life so much easier because I can just put it into the computer, but it also tracks certain patterns and it times it, so the validity is really strong. So Dibbles and Acadience are two highly reliable measures for screening all students quickly, reliably, and it's free. So if you want, the digital platform isn't free, but the paper pencil is free. So all on their websites. And so they provide those areas that we know measure future reading health. So they're great predictors. They're not perfect because no child is going to present exactly the same. And we know that we have to have someone who really understands the data to be able to interpret it well. So I love that they're timed, and that, as we know, is crucial for dyslexic students because that is their main deficit, is the processing of spoken words and written words. So that timed measure, that automaticity piece, is just really what we need to be looking for. How long does it take them to process? So I see it all the time, those looks when they're really just searching. They're searching for it. It's somewhere, but it just takes a moment for them. So universal screeners, huge. but also diagnostics. But yes, universal screeners are so necessary. And I love seeing new Georgia legislation passing the requirement of that for all early readers, rather than just if they happen to notice that they're struggling, then screen them. We need to screen everyone.
And in New Jersey, there's legislation for years now that all students had to be screened for dyslexia by the middle of second grade, I think it was. And before the days of universal screeners, there was a dyslexia screening committee, and it would kind of be the separate battery of things that we would look at. But like you said, when we have universal screeners in place for everyone, that already is providing so much information to see those initial red flags and to see, you know, which students might need further assessing to really pinpoint and target. And I really appreciate how you talked about that processing of speed too, because it's not always just about the accuracy. Right. It's about that automaticity piece. And I think that's an important piece of the puzzle we need to take into consideration.
Absolutely. In the works is a new definition of dyslexia, and the IDEA is proposing it to the public currently. And one of the pieces that they are proposing to shift the language around a little bit is to focus in on the language of fluency. So really, it is a speed thing. When you've worked with students who struggle to read, and you've seen it time and time again presented differently, because all students with dyslexia have a different profile in which they are struggling with the written or spoken part of language, you just see that be the consistent thread. So I'm grateful that that isn't the secondary part of the old definition, had that as like kind of the secondary consequence of dyslexia. And now we're seeing it as a primary indicator, is that lack of fluency, not just oral reading fluency, but fluency of sounds, fluency of words, and just that speed. But yes, accuracy is important as well. But that piece really comes into play when we get into the diagnostics.
Yeah. And then we can see with further assessments after you pinpoint kids with universal screening, you know, that rapid automatic naming is so important too.
Yes. Yes. I love that MCLAS, we assess using DIBELS. And in our MCLAS section, we have the letter naming, which is the same thing, but then they have an additional RAN. And then they have an additional oral language and an additional vocabulary. They have all these additional measures that you can give once you start to notice a pattern. Because, of course, we don't want to over-assess children. That is the last thing that they need. But these are quick and they're super reliable, and you can get information in a fast manner. So I appreciate that about DIBELS.
Yeah, that's so great. So when it comes to data analysis, what should we be looking for beyond the labels of above grade level, below grade level, below benchmark?
Right. Well, you touched on it a little bit when you were talking about accuracy. So we have those students who fly through and ace the DIBELS benchmark, or they ace the Acadience benchmark because they were fast. But there were errors all over the place, and there were specific errors in short vowels, or with that last sound, they were bringing it into the first sound of the next word, or they skipped a line and there's a tracking issue. So you have to dig a little deeper, a lot deeper really, within the universal screener to be able to get valuable data and individualized data. So we have students who are sight word readers, who are able to store those sight words quickly, but you put a nonsense word in front of them and they don't know what to do with it. Or they have the vocabulary and the knowledge about the passage and their ORF is really strong. But then you go back again and that nonsense word component is not there. So we look for splits, just like a psychologist would when they're looking at different things and they're diagnosing certain patterns and thinking and IQ and all of that. We do the same when we're looking at data as reading teachers. We look at, where is their split? If something's high over here and it's low here, what happened and how can we fill in that gap?
Yeah, that's really helpful to see where is the discrepancy there. So when it comes to analyzing errors, whether it's on further diagnostic assessments that we can use to drive our instruction and create our groupings, How can coaches or reading specialists, you know, you're in both roles, support classroom teachers with this work?
Yes. Yeah, so classroom teachers, I mean, I'm not too far from being a classroom teacher that I cannot remember how difficult it is to be a classroom teacher. And whatever we can do to ease their load, any little bit that we can do to lift that responsibility that they have with their classrooms, where they have up to, in some schools, 30 students. So what I like to do to support our faculty here and our wonderful classroom teachers is I like to take the data and I like to put it into a spreadsheet, help sort it for them. We do complete thorough diagnostic assessments because we want to know exactly who it is in front of us. So universal screening is a great start, but that's not where we stop. We complete an alphabet write that we have timed. We do uppercase and lowercase alphabet writes. So I'm just going to use first grade as an example because they give the most assessments. We also give a spelling and reading of previously taught graphemes. So we would say the sound, they would repeat it and spell it as best they can, noting reversals, noting visual spatial concerns, noting all the things that we can to learn about the child. So we do a lot of dictation and we want them spelling, and we do use a lot of nonsense because we need to make sure they're not using their schema or what they've memorized. So we do have them also read high frequency words to see where they are with that. And we look at all of that and I put it into a large spreadsheet that's sortable with the help from our fabulous technology coach. She helps me create that and I'm working on my Excel skills, but I do find that that is helpful. And then that's how we can group our students in a way that is just data driven rather than, oh, we think somebody should be over here because some reason, like it's not in data. So it's very data driven. We meet together often. I also progress monitor our students where they have a few red flags or where there may be gaps in learning to ensure growth. And then we talk about what we can do in the classrooms to better support them. And then, of course, I actually do pull their students and work with their students. And in that way, it feels like we're really co-teachers and I do push in. I am basically a reading teacher for most of the school. So I'm popping in and I'm supporting as I can. So really, it's very family oriented. There's a lot of empathy there. My biggest piece of advice is to just build that relationship with the classroom teachers. Build that first, build that trust, and come alongside and don't wait to do something for them. Just see the need and go towards it. And that will work really well.
Yeah, and it just goes to show what a collaborative effort it is with the reading specialist and the classroom teacher and like all hands on deck. And we have to work together to move these mountains because someone can't just do it with their door shut and trying to do the best they can. It's really helpful when it's like such a team effort and having all that information in one place and having the consistent conversations and, you know, what are our next moves going to be?
Right.
That's all a big piece of the puzzle.
Yes, definitely.
You talked about the different learning profiles of the child, right? So what are some of the different things that we can assess for that might raise a red flag for dyslexia in particular?
Yeah, so informally, we have a lot of informal measures. I definitely love the core phonics survey. I love knowing specifically what grapheme a child hasn't mastered yet, either for reading or for spelling. I want to know exactly where the struggle is. So I personally, when a child is reading a list of words to me, I am marking if they are still sounding it out with dots. And then I'm swooping when they're fluent. So in my mind, you know, I don't have the timer on for this, but this is just a diagnostic. And we're just taking tons and tons of notes about reading behavior. So looking past the universal screener, a good phonics survey is a beautiful place to start your instruction to be able to get diagnostic and prescriptive with an individual. And then we do ask the children to write on a topic. And so getting them to, if they're able to write, If they're in kindergarten, they're drawing pictures to and then they're orally explaining to us what they have written about or the experience that they're telling us about. And this piece is really huge because oral language and decoding, that knowledge, that oral language times decoding equals comprehension. We cannot get so stuck in breaking the code that we forget to build strong vocabulary, build strong oral language skills in our students. But if there is a lack of that, then we know that needs to be built on just as much as T spells T. Like, we need to start with complete sentences. How do we name something? A namer and a doer. We're talking grammar. Everything's explicit. So we assess that. We assess speech patterns and just the depth of vocabulary that students have when they come to us. So we're really taking lots of notes and making sure that we're looking for those mispronunciations possibly in kindergarten, which, as we know, is a red flag for dyslexia. So early on, language delays, speech difficulty with pronunciation beyond the age-appropriate speech pronunciations that we know that we teach in kindergarten, that TH sound that is not really appropriate until 7 years old to master that in their language. But we are teaching it. We're teaching them that appropriate sound. But if we have basketti, or we have consistent mispronunciations, or just difficulty with expressive and receptive language, we're watching for that early on. Difficulty rhyming, difficulty naming the letters, or even naming the days of the week or the months of the year. All of those things are linked to difficulty with reading later on.
And oftentimes when students are younger, we think that kind of thing is cute. Like, oh my goodness, they said spaghetti instead of spaghetti. And even with my own daughter right now, I have two daughters, but one is 2.5. And when she was first learning to speak, I'm noticing that some of her words are completely backwards. And instead of cup, she was saying puck. And chapstick is patch stick. With my literacy hat on, I was like, oh my goodness, we have to like watch out for this and just keep an eye on it. And here I'm saying my sound slowly. If the word is confusing for her, I'm like over enunciating and saying those sounds like very, very much segmented. So she hears which phonemes they are. And some words have remedied and some haven't. And again, she's only 2.5, but it's something to keep an eye on if that's going to be a persistent pattern later as she develops.
Yes, we never take that hat off, do we?
Yeah. My husband's like, you're crazy. I'm like, no. Help her. Gotta advocate for your own children too.
I did let go the word defore instead of before. I let my son say that a few times just for my own enjoyment, and then I swooped in and
exactly
pronunciation.
Yeah. So you mentioned some of the signs that we might notice early on in a student's career. Are there other signs that we might take note of at particular grade levels that might be a red flag?
Yes. So I already shouted out the IDA. So the International Dyslexia Association is a must visit website for anyone who wants to know anything about reading, not just dyslexia. So they have an incredible library and an incredible just vault, treasure trove of resources that are all rooted and deeply researched concepts. But they have a survey, a preschool survey, that is free. And I think I have it linked somewhere. At some point I had it linked in my bio, and it's probably on my website, because I believe so firmly in early intervention. We can spot dyslexia. Dyslexia can be noticed, or even the red flags show up as early as 3. Harvard just came out with that study that at 3 years old, we can see signs for dyslexia. So we can truly change the trajectory of a child's life, their view of themselves, by screening them early, by intervening early, and just eliminating some of that, you know, that pain and that anguish of struggling to learn how to read. So what we can watch for early on are those language delays, which we touched on, that difficulty with pronunciation. Like I talked about, the memory and the rhyme, all of that is before kindergarten. Before they even come into kindergarten, we can notice that about our students or our own children, and just not ring the bells and be super worried, because it's just, it may be cause for getting more information. So once we put the code in front of them is when we're really going to know how they can work in front of it, once we put some letters in front of them. But another one for elementary students that we want to be mindful of is slow and effortful. How quickly are they able to read? If it's not with ease and it's slow and effortful for longer than you would expect, because learning how to read is difficult, but with the explicit and systematic, structured literacy teacher in front of them that is highly qualified to give them that knowledge and how to read, how quickly are they able to do it? So if you notice frequent errors in reading and spelling, that is also a red flag. So the word frequent is the one that should jump out to you. If a B and D reversal happens here and there before 8 years old, I'm not super worried about that. That's developmentally appropriate. But if we're confusing our vowels, or if we're pulling a sound from another word that you just read over to the other one, then I am concerned about phoneme processing. And that is a cause for learning more about that child. But then we have older children. Lord willing, that doesn't happen on my watch, but there are older children who go undiagnosed. There are adults who go undiagnosed. I oftentimes run into them. I actually spoke with a refrigerator repairman recently who we just got to talking, and he asked what I did for a living. And he was certain, he was thinking, oh my goodness, I think I have dyslexia. And just talking about the trauma of that an emotional response towards reading. For those older kids, do not make an older child who doesn't want to read out loud read out loud. That is a big no-no. Writing challenges. So the writing increases as we get older. The demand on our spelling and all of that to just be automatic is almost just an expectation that you can crank out an essay. So if you have older children or adults who are struggling with writing, consider that there could be a reason why that is difficult. And then we have those similar words that were, where, they, there, and then those omissions of function words like it, of, the, that is a hallmark of an older student who is struggling with written language. So those are just a few of the very many things to look for.
That's such a comprehensive list already. And I'm thinking overcoming dyslexia, Sally Shaywitz was like my first dyslexia Bible. She has a ton of lists, but there's so many great resources. IDEA is fabulous too, where we can tap into some more potential indicators. And it's not to say if you have a child that does a few of these things that they necessarily have dyslexia, but it does raise a little ear to wonder, you know, is there something worth investigating further?
Yes, I love how you said that.
And so in the beginning, when you were sharing about your role, you talked about how you love interacting with parents and community, and parent partnerships are such a huge piece in supporting our learners, especially those that have dyslexia. So how do you approach some of these conversations when concerns may first arrive in schools, or when you're guiding families through next steps? A lot of institutions are like, you're not allowed to say the D word.
Yes. So I love that question. So I did skip a part in my bio where I spent 3 years as a private tutor, and I was becoming certified through the Orton-Gillingham Academy at the same time. And I was really speaking candidly with families because they had hired me. They were my client. So I could just share every single thing that I noticed. We could speak as frankly as we could about what that meant, the implications of that. But always, even then, I am not a psychologist. I cannot diagnose dyslexia. A psychologist can't even see inside your child's brain, but we would love to have that trick, right? To be able to see exactly what's going on, but they get really close And I have read many psych ed reports, and they are mind-blowing what psychologists are able to uncover with the technology now, but then also just the testing that they do. And that is not my area of expertise. Dyslexia is not a bad word here. And there's no stigma to dyslexia. In the school where I'm working, we celebrate dyslexia. We celebrate ADHD. We celebrate all of the ways that God has made our brains to work differently, to show off what we can do in our own unique way. And reading is a fairly new convention. So we encourage and empower our students who have a lot of them will raise their hand and say, I'm dyslexic, because they have gotten that diagnosis from a psychologist. But back to parents. Parents are more educated now about dyslexia than ever before. And it is amazing. Thanks to this movement that has taken place that started decades ago. But the information is spreading like wildfire that, you know, dyslexia and intelligence are separate. So we never tell anyone that we think their child has dyslexia. We only speak to what we're noticing in the classroom and data points that are very specific and that, as we like to call it, are unexpected given what amount of support or given the amount of intelligence we're seeing in the child or given what we would expect at this point in the school year or given the instruction that they've received. So the first thing is to build trust. I am a mom, so that's helpful because I have three children who are going through school. And so the amount of empathy that I feel when we're sitting around at a table as a team to come alongside of and support a family is really a big privilege that I get to carry as our reading specialist. I get to be a part of many vulnerable conversations that honestly I just treasure up in my heart. And so they need to know first and foremost that I love their child and that because I love their child and love them, that I'm going to give them clearly what I see and raise what is concerning about what I might see. Clear is kind. This is what I see. This is where nationally, or, you know, we may use data to say this is where we are compared to this norm. This is where I think we could be. And we set growth goals and we progress monitor and we do this because we love the kids. And I present the data in an understandable way. So we have a document that we've come up with to explain what the nonsense word read is, to explain what letter naming is and what it can indicate. And we're very clear with families because that's what we would want as moms. We would want to know everything that we can to best intervene early, which is the goal, is that we would have these conversations in kindergarten, in first grade. As soon as we see something, we say something. It's urgent. Learning how to read is an urgent matter, and we're in the heart protection business. And then I just think following up is always very important too. So we can only hear so much as parents, like myself included. So that first initial meeting, then, okay, how did that sit with you? And I always start the conversation with, please tell me about your child. Please tell me what you're noticing about the child. And I do a lot of listening. Because I know that moms, dads, caregivers, they know their child more than I do. And they know what their areas are of growth. And it just gives so much insight. And then we do oftentimes have parents share their story. Oh, yeah, I struggled with this. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. This was hard for me too. So there's a lot of love in that conversation. And there's a lot of, we're with you. We all want what's best for your kid. And so, like I said, it's a privilege to be a part of those conversations.
Can I just say, I love that. I love that you come from this empathetic heart. And oftentimes, these are really challenging conversations to have. And we don't want to lead with opinions. We want to lead with the data and have the cold, hard facts. But not to let the cold, hard facts be cold and to have an empathetic heart, I think is really important where you're working with humans, but there is this sense of urgency and to find dance
put that very well. It is a fine dance, and it really is just such a hard thing to walk into, but it's the right thing. And I've always felt that deep down in my heart as I've worked with students, is I never want to let that opportunity pass me by. And I just, honesty is, these families are trusting us with their kids and they need to know what we're noticing.
100%. And then, do you have any specific examples of some language that you might use with parents, or, you know, you shared some, or even tips that you would share on some of these first encounters?
Yes, I usually do come if, you know, I'm not too slammed with classes and other meetings and things like that. I try to bring something. I try to bring some games. I try to bring some tools. I try to bring something fun for them to work on at home. But then I also want to give them the grace and say, hey, you get to be mom. You get to be dad. You get to be the lap that they sit on and hear a story from. That is working on reading. We're going to teach them how to read. They're going to work hard at school. They're going to be exhausted, and they should be at the end of the day, because they are reading the whole time. They are working on breaking the code. So the common language is just that we do little bits every day. We're not cramming for anything, and we're making it fun. We're making it lighthearted. So I do bring in the deck, the drill deck, with some letter sounds, and I teach them how to successively blend, because a lot of our students who are struggling to learn how to read are still going up, and their working memory is slower. That unnecessary segmentation can be smoothed together, like top. And then I show them, for their child specific profile of what I've learned about their child, ways to target that area of weakness. So if it's that last sound, I show them to just, okay, for 30 seconds every day after school, play this game and then flip out the last sound. Great. Go outside and play. So I just know what's manageable for me as a mom. And I love to just be mom when I get home too. So the common language really is that we do use MZ. It's an approach, and they have a ton of resources to come alongside of the approach that is Wharton-Gillingham based. So we call spelling finger tap your words when we're writing a thank you note. We train our parents. We have parent workshops. We have what we call Parent U, which is like Parent University, where we show them all the resources that their kid used throughout the year and how they can use it during the summer, fun games. We have a literacy night coming up where we are going to teach them how the brain learns to read so that they can have that information. We give videos for how to correctly pronounce the phonemes and how to cut off that that and say "buh," instead of "kuh." So we do those little things throughout the year to just bring cohesion. And I think it works really, really well. I worked in a school a long time ago where I would get asked, why don't you give a spelling list for the spelling words? I have not once been given that question since working in my new school, because I think it's so clear why we're doing what we're doing and how it's impacting our readers positively.
I love all of those parent collaborations, and you can integrate even consistent language at home, which is so important, and keeping it manageable for parents and not overwhelming them. Like, these were 20,000 activities that you need to do.
Share our scope and sequence with them. So we're very open. The door is open. Here is what your child should know based off of what they've been directly taught. And so that's what they're given for the whole year. They can see what's going to be taught when, and then how to support that and come alongside that at home.
And that's so beneficial. You know, you think back to balanced literacy days and parent-teacher conferences and sharing a reading level. Like, what does that mean to a parent? You're a level H. Okay. I don't even know what a level H book is. These skills, I have no idea what that means. But to actually share, these are the skills that your child has been working on.
Yes.
You know, if you're reading a book and you come across some of these words,
yes,
these are things that they'll be able to read.
It's amazing. Our first grade team is phenomenal in that they have these binders that have decodable passages in them. And then the scope is in the front. It's beautiful. They have the scope and sequence. I can't take credit for this. This existed before I came. But they have decodable passages, opportunities to practice in multi-sensory ways, and just all kinds of gold for parents to be able to say, okay, maybe a child isn't ready to read an authentic book yet. Here's this story. And we know that they can read it because it's based off of what's been taught. So we just provide a lot. And kindergarten also sends home book bags, and they get so excited for when they're able to do that. We send it them about January, February. So by then we have readers and they're individualized to the child based off of what we know that they can do.
And that's so great to have materials that they could practice at home that they actually can read, which is so important. I'm so excited for this next bit because you mentioned you have several high impact routines that can support dyslexic learners and truly all students. So maybe we can run through them a bit.
Yes. So high impact strategies overall, I'm just going to talk about the science of learning, is to continuously make sure, and this is a hard one, but teacher talk to a minimum and student application and teacher feedback amplified. So think about your average lecture. If we're teaching kids how to read, or we're teaching students any kind of content or knowledge, we're going to give them something and we're going to expect them to be able to retrieve it. And just that in and of itself, as a broader term, just this science of learning, when we are acting in retrieval mode, and it's hard for kids to do at first, but when we are constantly keeping them accountable to what we're saying, let's say we teach them the vowel team EE. EE spells E as in tree. What does EE spell? E. Okay, spell all the ways that you know how to spell E on your whiteboard. You immediately expect them to do that. And then they're going back. They're going back and they're tying it to something sticky. You know, it's information loves to stick to each other. So just keeping that umbrella of the science of learning in mind always. So retrieval. So constantly having students retrieve what we're teaching, limiting our teacher talk, cut the fluff, say what needs to be learned, how you're going to learn it, what it is, and then student responses immediately with feedback and with cognitive feedback. Ask them how they got there. So that's building in metacognition because we want our students to be thinking about their thinking, thinking about whether they have something or not, or thinking about what they need to do to get there. So even in kindergarten, we are building in thumbs up, thumbs to the side, and thumbs down. Like, this is how I feel about this from the beginning. So it doesn't feel weird. So we want to be comfortable with where we are in our learning journey because learning to read is hard. So overall, I would say that because oftentimes we think of reading as the pillars, right? Remember the old pillars where we think of everything as separate. And while we can look at them separately, they really need to be integrated as much as possible. But if we're talking high impact, spelling, huge. There's so much research to support that when we form our letters, it sends a signal to our brain so much faster than if we're just passively learning the language. So we want to be using whiteboards. I use whiteboards all the time. Those word chains are really helpful for phonemic awareness activities too. So chain can become rain, rain can become rail, that sort of thing. So those are super high impact. Word sorts are super high impact. Old school, love a word sort. Word sorting with spelling or word sorting with reading. And then build in some language in there. Show me all the words that have to do with each other. Let's sort all of those. Or let's sort all the adjectives out. Let's sort all the nouns out. Let's build some sentences. So the more explicit we can be throughout all areas of reading, the better. So we have work to do with fluency. Sometimes we think that because a child is in second grade or third grade that they're going to be fluent. They've learned how to read the words, so they're going to be fluent. But really what they need is for us to break it apart and bring syntax awareness, which actually builds comprehension. I love a sentence scramble I think that's super high impact, moving around a sentence that's decodable for a child. And then what's really fun is taking out words and replacing it with others to build oral language skills. And then all throughout that, we have to build knowledge. Science and social studies is not as prevalent as it used to be. Classical knowledge about fairy tales and science and life cycles and all of that, the depth of knowledge that used to be present in our world is not as present in our schools. And we need to bring that back in alongside of all of this. And I don't know how we're all going to do it perfectly, but that is going to be the big journey that I think all of us are on. And I think one of the best things that we can do to build knowledge is to integrate as much as we can in our schedule to be surrounded by the topic that we're learning about. You're reading about what it is that you're learning about. Let's say it's space. And then you're building vocabulary around space. You're picking your tier 2, tier 3 words around space. You're using AI to come up with chants and songs that have to do with space. Always more to learn. Her page, Megan, just follow her and you'll be good.
Shout out Megan Hine.
But she's just doing that so beautifully in her classroom. And I think that she shows what it really looks like to build language and to build knowledge with the knowledge of how the language works too. We can't think of everything as such separate entities when it's all encompassing, but I think we would be remiss if we didn't understand how learning works. I also want to shout out Dr. Pooja Agarwal. She's a neurocognitive scientist. She authored Powerful Teaching. And that book was life-changing for me because, well, the research is so clear that we're not teaching in a way that requires learning from our kids, then they're not going to learn how to read. So the way that we have students practice and use what we're teaching them is even, if not more important than what we're teaching them. So can they do it? We want them to fly. We want them to do it on their own.
I love how you opened up with that whole science of learning piece. And right when you were talking about it, I was like, oh my goodness, you and Megan are my science of learning girls.
That book, and she did, and she, or it might have been a different book.
The orange one.
Uncommon Teaching.
Yes. And I bought it. I was like, you both influenced me.
Yes. So I definitely recommend, it's part of the team that I'm on now as we get to, I had mentioned that I'm a learning specialist too, which is a fun and humbling journey to even say that I'm a learning specialist because I'm learning about learning all the time. But we just have a fabulous team here that encourages just studying cognitive science. And there seemed to be for years a disconnect between the cognitive science piece and the classroom piece. Or at least that's how we got into the reading wars, so to speak, is that there's been a disconnect between research and practice. And I love that we have a team that is committed to staying on top of what's latest, but also it confirms much of what we've done in the past. So we don't throw everything out. We're just saying, oh, that's why that worked. And here's some new data and here's some new ways that we can think about what we're already doing.
Yeah, and implementation is the hardest.
It is.
Why? Yeah. I really appreciate everything that you said about whoever is doing the talking is doing all of the work. And
yeah,
the importance of having that student application is so important. And oftentimes when people hear explicit instruction, they're like, oh no, that's so dry. And the teacher's just sage on the stage, sharing all of his or her wisdom, and students are supposed to be sponges just taking in the wisdom. And that's not the case. It's a lot of student practice and application and eliciting responses in different ways and really making sure that the learning is sticking. And everything that you said is really, really high impact. Powerful stuff to make that happen.
Yeah, I love that. Definitely. I think we should not come home with sore throats, and teachers tend to have like the most injured vocal cords. I remember that from my education courses. Our music teacher at Auburn was talking about your throat's going to be the most injured, like your larynx or something. Teachers have horrible vocal cords, apparently. And I thought about that after whoever's doing the talking does the learning. And just as I've continued in education, I'm doing less and less talking. And I think that's a good thing. And the kids are doing more and more talking. And what I say is very strategic. And of course, I'm singing opera and doing all the things to get their engagement. And yes, I do go home with a hoarse voice every once in a while.
But your vocal cords are tired for a different reason.
Yeah. It's all my fault. Yeah.
So this has been so wonderful. You have so much value to share. For any other fellow literacy coaches or literacy specialists listening, what's one piece of advice that you'd give to better support their teachers in their schools when they're navigating serving students with dyslexia in particular?
Yeah, I think that's such a great question. So the main thing I would say is to put themselves in the shoes of the child. No kid wants to struggle. There's not a single person on the planet who wants for reading to be difficult. So just meeting them in their gaps. And then as a reading specialist coming alongside teachers, just validating the difficulty in that. It is difficult. It's going to be difficult for the child. And then it's going to be a lot of work for that teacher, but that teacher has the privilege of coming alongside them. And then as a reading specialist, we get to come alongside the teacher. And then also, I think another thing that our teachers really appreciate here is that I come into meetings with them and the parents, and it feels like, okay, I have your back. Like, I have your back here. This is a difficult conversation that we're going to be having, and I'm here for you. I'm here for you to help you and present and, you know, prepare all that data, prepare all that communication for the teacher to say, hey, this, I got you. Just build that trust and use proven methods and then use that growth data to spur them on. We all see the chart go up. Like, we're all excited about that. So like, just keep that in mind.
Yeah. It's like you keep the students at the forefront of the conversation. It's all about them. It's not about you.
Yes. Yeah. And you're hoping to get, what do you love about teaching? Like, what do you love about Susie? What is the strength? And how can we best serve them? So I think just bringing practical tips too. Like, if it's an actual skill that they need support in, like, hey, I've tried this and it works really well. I wonder if that would work for your child.
For a teacher listening, maybe a classroom teacher who never had formal training in dyslexia, what's a message that you want them to take away from today's conversation?
What I hope that they would take away from this is that the rooted in the science of reading instruction that you give works for dyslexic students. So if you're doing what research says is best for kids to learn, that dyslexic student is benefiting from it. And they are the teacher that is supposed to be in front of that child and to ask for help and to reach out to those who have experience working with dyslexic students. And a dyslexic child deserves a team of people who are coming alongside of them to eliminate frustration and to protect their hearts. There's so much that we can do to alleviate some of that exhaustion that exists for students who have dyslexia, and to just try your very, very best to not say phrases like try harder, or I'm like, gosh, I said this already. Why don't you get it yet? Dyslexia is a brain-based neurobiological deficit in the area of processing language. And it isn't because they don't want to, it's because it's difficult. And think of the most difficult thing that you've ever learned to do, if you've had anything be difficult, and think about being forced to do that over and over and over and over again. So just come alongside them with the most tender love and care, because they deserve it. And you've got this.
What a beautiful nod of inspiration. I love it. No, that's a really powerful message. So Jean, this was such a wonderful and insightful conversation. It's clear that you are such an expert at what you do, and your school and your district is so lucky to have you. And again, you're on social media, so the whole world is lucky to have you at their disposal and seeing all the wonderful tips that you share. Where can listeners connect with you further if they're interested in learning more about everything that you have to share?
Yes, so I do have an Instagram account. It's My Reading Genie, and just a play on my first name, Jean, and my two teacher friends from my previous school actually came up with the name. So shout out to Katie and Becky if y'all are listening. So just My Reading Genie. And then I do have a website. It's myreadinggenie.com. And I try to get on there as much as I can. But if you don't see me for a while, it's because I am literally working with students all day doing what I love. But stick around and I will get some good stuff coming your way. I love the community. I mainly love it for follows like you and Megan and others. And then the best part is when I get to connect with a parent who is having a huge light bulb moment and is asking me questions about how to support their dyslexic child. So my DMs are full of questions about dyslexia and I love it. So keep those coming and that's where y'all can find me.
Well, we know whose door to come knocking on because you do know so much and have so much value to share. So again, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you so much for tuning into Literacy in Color. I hope today's episode left you feeling both inspired and equipped with something new to add to your teaching toolkit. If you're enjoying this podcast, it would truly mean so much to me if you'd leave a 5-star review. It helps other educators find the show and join our colorful community. And don't forget to hit the follow or subscribe button so you never miss an episode. For more tips, tools, and resources, be sure to check out the links in the show notes at michelleandthecolorfulclassroom.com. Thanks again for listening, and I'll catch you next week. Until then, be colorful and teach colorfully.